Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, we presented a live edition of the program at the Sioux City Public Library. The topic was the effect of tariffs on agricultural and industrial products. Those tariffs were issued in retaliation for those introduced by President Donald Trump a little over a year ago. Those tariffs focused on China, but affected other countries like Canada as well. My guests for the program were Dave Bernstein, the co-owner of State Steel in Sioux City, Dr. Sam Funk with the Iowa Farm Bureau, Mary Zink, assistant professor of business administration at Morningside College, Darren Tooley, the vice president of agricultural lending at Security National Bank in Sioux City, and Jim Miller, farmer and former head of the Nebraska Soybean Association. My first question for the panel was whether the tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump to deal with imbalances in the trade market was actually needed, and whether those tariffs were a good way to deal with the problem. First, we hear from Darren Tooley from Security National Bank.
I think there was inequality throughout. One can debate whether this is the right method to try to resolve it. And I think that's what we're trying to work towards, but we're trying to get a world trade that really does provide balance and puts the U.S. on a more favorable advantage if we try to market our products.
Mary Zink, what do you think about that?
Well, the imbalance in trade is actually increased, so it's difficult to say if this has been successful. The other thing that's interesting is although the real complaint that the United States had against China had to do with intellectual property. The
right.
Tariffs that have come from China onto the United States really aren't affecting that industry much at all.
Right. So he's trying to gain leverage in these areas, and maybe it isn't really affecting the things he wants to affect?
I think that's probably true. Plus, you have to consider the enormous volume of exports from China. You know, they export
right.
all over the world. So
right.
it's not a large effect on their overall exports.
Jim Miller, what do you think?
Well, I think it is something that, you know, President Trump was one of the first presidents to stand up to China and say that we need to have a better balance of trade. And so he is trying to accomplish something in that aspect. One of the things that China was always a challenge for us in the soybean industry was that we always came up with new biotech traits, and they was very slow at approving the new biotech traits, which hindered us in production agriculture from having the ability to use these new traits and make us a more sustainable production system. One of the traits, the Dow and List trait, was in China's hands for 7 years waiting for approval. They say that they should approve new traits in 3 years or less. And so that was a real challenge for us in the Xtend trait, to be able to use Banville-type product on our soybeans, went way over the time limit of being able for the approval process. And so this is supposed, with the challenges that we're having and hopefully through the negotiations, that's going to help resolve some of those issues in biotechnology, trade approval, and that type of thing. So we're hopeful that we will see some benefits to the challenges that we're going through right now. And we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Right. Dr. Funk, what do you think? Do you think that the president had a point in saying we needed to do something about the imbalance in trade?
Well, obviously we had an imbalance in trade, and that's very well documented. And I think the other aspect is that we really did have an issue, even with intellectual property within agriculture. We saw seeds with genetics being dug up in the dirt and taken over to foreign countries, and China was one of those. So it is something where that intellectual property did make a difference for agriculture as well, not only around the globe or in the United States, but actually here in Iowa. So I think there's some things that it did impact. And I will say very few who are directly engaged in any sort of a trade skirmish with tariffs will ever win. The only potential winner for that trade skirmish was when Brazil was able to sell soybeans for, you know, $30 a metric ton more than what they would have otherwise. Yes. And that was a calculation that I'd been engaged with in calculating that became public. And so, you know, it was very well documented that the cash basis, the cash bids down there were higher than they could have been. But at the same time, one thing that really happened, China came to the table. And we are a significant buyer of goods from China. China knows we're a number one size economy for being able to buy their goods. And they were feeling economic pressure in there as well. So we can't say that it didn't do any good. It did bring them to the table to address certain things. And we heard Secretary Pompeo say that when he came in here to Iowa just here in the last couple of weeks. So we know that it did make some effects, and it brought them to have at least discussions in that regard. Will we win because of it? I don't know, but it also wasn't just Trump. If you look back at the elections when you had the Republican and Democratic candidates who were vying for that role, they both said that they were going to renegotiate and bring people to the table because they wanted to be able to make massive changes to trade. So it wasn't just Trump, and I think that's important for us to realize. And we got basically what we were expecting at that point in time, that we were going to have this type of a trade issue take place.
Mm. Dave Bernstein, what do you think?
I think from the steel perspective, I think there was an issue with steel dumping, like line pipe and things. But right. From our perspective, I think the technique or the methodology used was completely ineffective or wrong in just a straight 25% tariff. I think there could have been, from our industry, quotas and tariffs on the items that were problematic as opposed to just a blanket tariff on everything. I think what you saw was massive inflation in steel, which was passed on to the 30 to 50 times multiplier of jobs in manufacturing and yield itself in inflation in a lot of products, whether artificial or real. Yeah. And then the crashing of steel pricing just recently in December and January to a net effect of just slightly raising the floor, because at $900 a ton steel, any company that wants to will dump steel in the U.S. and pay the 25% tariff, as we saw. The trade imbalance was worse last year than ever. It just wasn't the best policy. I think in some ways it was driven by Wilbur Ross, who's a steel guy in the end, who saved Inland Steel and Bethlehem Steel by rolling them into ISG and ultimately selling to ArcelorMittal. And so they knew steel. I do find it humorous when people say to me, oh, it's great that the steel industry is doing better now. And I'm like, listen, the steel industry has been very robust in the U.S., including many new mills, including a wonderful one in Iowa and a brand new one in Arkansas that just opened as well. It's just shifted. It's not in Pennsylvania anymore. The steel jobs are in Gary, Indiana, or in the south near the auto plants, and or in Montpelier, Iowa. So I think the technique was bad. In the end, I think it caused retaliation against places like Iowa that I think we're still maybe either in denial on or just starting to see the effect of in the backlash relating to soybeans, pork exports, ag exports in general. Ag manufacturing is very soft, and ag manufacturers that you talk to are very concerned. And I think that was ready for a comeback that just got delayed a year or two, and we really need that to happen. So hopefully there's resolution soon with China, Mexico, Canada, and hopefully there's not auto tariffs that go into play, which could exacerbate that even further by bringing Japan into the mix.
Auto tariffs?
There was discussion of limitations of auto imports.
Oh, right. But that didn't necessarily happen.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but You never really know when it's going to happen. And if it does happen, it will drag Japan, I think, into the mix as well.
Right.
Retaliation, and I think that's going to put more hurt on Iowa and other ag-driven economies. And we all live and breathe ag, and we need strong crop prices, and we need strong pork and cattle prices, and we need people buying combines and sprayers, and we have a lot of manufacturing in the state that is doing okay, but not great. Right. So I think we're kind of on the bubble right now.
Jim. Mostly when I hear about farmers suffering with the tariffs, I hear about soybean farmers. I know that a lot of soybeans are exported. I mean, is that why? Because there's such a big export market for our soybeans?
Yes, it is. Last year, we exported 60% of all the soybeans we grew in the U.S. China was our number one customer, taking over half of all of our exports. So exports are very vital to the soybean industry, and also, you know, all of our ag sector relies on exports. And so anytime we have a disruption with these tariffs like this, it does have a negative impact on the prices, and it does have a effect to us on our ability to make a good cash flow.
I've heard that some farmers were storing soybeans, not finding an adequate price to sell them. What have you heard about how they're coping, and has the payments that the government set up to help them along, have those payments helped?
Yeah, the payments have helped, but in production agriculture, we would much rather get our money from the marketplace, not from aid from the government. And so we are really encouraging the administration to get the issues resolved and to do away with the tariffs, because we know that it hurts everybody in the end. And so that is, I know just this week the American Soybean Association was making their Capitol Hill visits, and that was one of their main focus talking points, was to have the administration get the tariff issue resolved and do away with the tariffs. Mm-hmm. And to not use tariffs as a means to try to balance trade in the future and to overcome the issues that are in front of them.
Mm. Darren Tooley, you're in ag lending. What have you seen in your business? I've heard that a lot of farmers have defaulted on loans because of the tariffs, and that land prices were going down. Is that right?
We have seen some land reduction. It hasn't been significant. I wouldn't say it's been heavily impacted in our area. We have seen, I would say, less interest in land, less parties coming to the table. So I think the future is in question where that goes. From the standpoint of the lending side, we're just looking at, you got to have that financial strength. And, so when you don't get your commodity price, it forces, it forces the ability for the lender to be able to work with you in a lot of sense. Working capital is crucial for your short-term financing. Maintaining that commodity price against the loans that you have for your inputs are just critical. Having a good land base behind you gives you leverage, gives you some opportunity for restructure. But that question is always out there but if we don't fix the problem, if we don't fix the shortage, how long do we run with a customer before you end up being short and having to kind of just draw that line? And so, whether it's, as you talked, the financial strength and the extending, sometimes the borrowers are just stepping out and they're actually going to get a job. We're seeing more people off the farm picking up that extra income and just trying to survive through.
Dr. Funk?
Darren makes an excellent point, especially when you start talking about the critical nature of some of these financial predicaments that farmers find themselves in right now. It's important for them to be able to manage their way through this. If you were to simply sell off acres, or to give up farming those acres out through there, oftentimes that gives you fewer acres to be able to operate in the future and can really jeopardize your future income. So when we start talking about, being able to refinance aspects, we're looking right now, when you compare this to the 80s, and there's been a lot of debate, does this look like the 80s or not? A lot of that debt has been transferred into real estate debt, and part of that's been the fact that ground has been worth so much more that they've been able to transfer part of that debt load instead of being on an annual operating note to the ground. But that creates another risk overall for the farm as well. You mentioned in the question to Darren, have we been seeing more defaults on loans?
Yeah.
If you look from 17 to 18 for the U.S. District Appellate Courts that handle the chapter which most farm bankruptcies fall under, Iowa is the only state within the two districts right around us which has actually seen a decrease in defaults from 17 into 18. So we actually had two fewer bankruptcies in that time. So there is financial pressure through there that's been reported both from the Kansas City Federal Reserve and from the Chicago Federal Reserve and the Minnesota Federal Reserve. There's still hardships going on even in the state of Iowa and in the state of Nebraska, without a doubt. In Iowa, the actual bankruptcies has actually gone down in those two time periods. But the financial stress is still there, and I think that's important for us to realize that farmers are going to have to be able to find some alternate income source or find some way to manage their way through this, and that's a difficult time.
Mm. Mary Zink, how much does this agricultural economy really affect the overall economy of the Midwest, I mean, especially Iowa?
Well, I think that it would be foolish to say anything other than that agriculture is the foundation of Iowa economy, and family farms have always been a really important part of that. Now, of course, we've seen a growth to more large farms, and so you may see the same number of acres under production, but you may see that some of those acres are now being produced by much larger producers. And that family farmers may be being squeezed out. Definitely one of the things we're seeing is off-farm income becoming critical to farmer success. And that means that either the farmer or the farmer's wife or someone from that household is working off the farm and pooling that income in order to make the farm financially viable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a real problematic issue because I was thinking about it this morning. When you leave the farm, if you are forced off your farm, if you cease being a farmer, one of the most important losses there is the knowledge loss. Like, I did not grow up a farmer, and I don't know how to farm. And after a couple generations, farm kids won't be farm kids anymore. And that's something that's very difficult to recover. It's not like I could go today. Even if I had the money, I couldn't go and be a farmer because I don't know how.
Hmm. And also it has an effect on the small towns.
Absolutely. And I think that ripple effect hits all those small towns, and then it ripples up to bigger cities like Sioux City, and then it ripples across the entire state. And where you see it is in the purchasing power that people have being reduced. You see it in other businesses seeing less income because farmers don't have money to spend.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Even education, my industry, is hit by it because we see a lot of children of farmers at Morningside College. We have a terrific program for agricultural studies, but if their parents can't send them there, they can't send them there.
Yeah. Jim Miller, do you see any of this out in Nebraska?
I guess one of the things, one of the things I'd like to comment there about what Mary said is we're losing the family farms, but a lot of farms as we grow, they change from what you would call a family farm to a corporation, mm-hmm. and it's to protect their assets and for other tax advantages and things as that as well. But that farm, even though it is a corporation, is still a family farm. I have two sons that are on the farm with me. We're not a corporation, but we have two sons that are farming. We all use the same equipment, and we share labor. And that has helped us grow, and it has also helped us to be able to use and justify the newer technology that we have in agriculture with the use of global positioning satellites and that type of thing to help us be more efficient, help us cut down on overlaps of our seed, our crop protection agents, our fertilizers, and that type of thing, where if I was still just a small farm, it's hard to justify those costs. But by working together and being a family farm that has grown, we're able to justify those newer technologies and help us to be a more sustainable farming operation. So I have seen a lot of farms grow, but in the last 12 to 15 years, there has been a lot of young people come back to the farm and start farming in my area. Whereas in the late 1980s and 1990s and early 2000, parents did not encourage their sons or daughters to come back to the farm. And so I've seen a real reversal in that we've had a lot of young people come back to the farm. And so these farms, just because they've grown and they are still family farms and are now corporations, it doesn't make them not a family farm.
I've heard people compare this to the 80s and the farm crisis. And Darren, what do you think about that comparison?
Actually, I'm young enough that I didn't go through the 80s. I went through them as a high school kid or a junior high. So I really don't have that basis. I know throughout the bank, there's a lot of our lending team that has, the thing that I would comment, what I've heard, we're just not as leveraged. Our borrowers do have a lot more flexibility in their balance sheet. I think we did learn from that. But if we see land prices drop, then we could see it become more of the 80s. And I'd default to anybody else that can answer that question better.
Well, I think that that's a definite, you know, aspect for consideration, especially as we talked about more leverage, more borrowing against the value of the ground out through there and that higher burden against that productive asset. You know, when we think about right now, we use the Iowa State Extension cost of production survey materials, and it's going to be coming out on the Iowa Farm Bureau website.com. Really soon. And we compared that to then taking some projected prices using December corn, November soybeans, and an average basis that's reported from IDOLs here in the state. And if you think about what returns out there, there might be a little bit of return for corn following soybeans off of that, and some very difficult periods where they could be riding more red again this year for corn on corn or soybeans following corn. You're just using, you know, average numbers out through there. So it could be a real challenge. And if we start to write more red for crops, that's going to be a really difficult thing going into this next year. I mean, it's hard enough to go into your banker and say, my plan is that I'm going to lose some cash this year and I'm going to have to draw down on some of my equity. That's a difficult conversation, but sometimes it's a conversation that needs to take place so you can manage your way through it and have a plan to go forward. You know, let me echo something that Jim had mentioned earlier, talking about, you know, his sons back on the farm and sharing equipment. And that's something that we've had a lot of generations in agriculture do, is they share equipment. Somebody comes in and they're looking for making contributions and helping that next generation come in. And that's critical. But you think about how efficient we are with production and how that's brought down some prices as well. It really has narrowed margins. It's been a margin game, and as margins got narrower, you had to increase the size of the farm to make a sufficient return to living so that you could afford to be a full-time farmer, or to have that as part of your operation where maybe you had some off-farm income that you brought in as well. But it's all critical to bring it around again to support those local economies. It's the value and contribution of agriculture to those local economies in Iowa and in Nebraska, and also to the industry as well, for the steel industry. And that was brought up earlier. What a difference agriculture makes when you start thinking about not just the inputs and the raw steel, but the fabrication behind what that steel goes to make the implements, to make the buildings, to make the bins that we hold more product in, and how it supports all of those local economies and builds it forward. It's such a strong contributor to agriculture that we need to be able to find a way to manage our way through this and to keep growing.
Dave?
I think to that point as well, in my role at the IEDA, the Economic Development Authority, and what we see for deals coming through there, we've seen impact in, I think, both the ag-related manufacturing-type businesses coming through and the deal flow significantly slowing, and also some folks who we have projects with delaying or deferring completion because they're slower as well, compared to other segments like financial services. And the other part of it that probably is stunted that, you know, there's a lot of lag in all this. What we see today doesn't necessarily show up in numbers for 6 months or a year sometimes. And the other spot you see it is potentially what's not happening in ag tech and some of those critical areas that Iowa really can be successful as an innovator. We have such a leg up as a state in the ability to, you know, through the universities and everybody else, to develop ag tech and really have that be a great product for the state, but we need to have a robust ag environment. You know, I think really we're at a critical point right now, and it was predicted, I think, at one of the ag shows in the fall by one of the seed manufacturers, in that March, April is going to be really the time that defines what's going to happen for the next year, and that's really going to have a big impact. And so hopefully this China discussion, I don't think it's coincidental,
right.
Hopefully this China discussion yield some results that give people some more optimism so that farmers going into this next season can feel maybe better and maybe upgrade equipment or spend some money or not have as much pressure at the banks. Because I'm sure you guys at the banks as well see this stuff a year or two after. I know we see it in our credit issues with our customers, ag manufacturers. It doesn't happen right away. It happens during fluctuations where all of a sudden lines of credit get tight. And that doesn't happen the day there's a tariff or the day there's a restriction, it might happen a year later or so. So hopefully something breaks loose here pretty quick that gives everybody some optimism going into this planting season.
I just wanted to say, so if Canada, if they finalize a deal with the U.S. and this trade agreement soon, I mean, what kind of a effect would that have? Would that take a while to...
You know, I can't speak to crop prices or pork prices at all.
But I think it's aluminum.
Yeah.
Is it steel and aluminum they're doing?
You know, steel and aluminum in and out of Mexico and Canada is probably not as big a driver. The problem with steel and aluminum is more the retaliatory tariffs on ag products, on soybeans and pork. That were introduced because of the steel and aluminum. So from our perspective, the steel and aluminum markets have somewhat stabilized, I think, in the U.S., but it's how it affects you all on farms with soybean prices or pork prices, ultimately from a retaliatory sense. So,
Dr. Funk?
It was brought up about what could be some of that good news and what might happen with these China discussions. So let's think about good news that could come about from this. So China has committed to purchasing an additional 10 million metric tons of soybeans. So what difference does it make to have an additional 10 million metric tons of soybeans going out? So I'm going to step back to last month's USDA static numbers just to give a point of reference. If you were to look at the stocks to use projected for the end of this marketing year that we're in right now, so coming on later on this fall, right before harvest for the majority of the crop, if you had it status quo without that 10 million metric tons, we go to one of the highest historic stocks to use for soybeans ever. We go to a utilization which continues to fall instead of grow. And we would continue to find ourselves likely with a pile of beans that still have to be moved, for lack of a better phrase. And maybe that's for a lot of people to understand, because we didn't just put all the beans in a bin. There were some places we had to put them in a pile outside. So if we think about what happens with an additional 10 million metric tons of soybeans that could be purchased by China, what happens? We actually get a stocks to use that falls lower than we had in 05, 06, and 06, 07. So it's not a record stocks to use. We have a higher overall utilization for the end of this year than we've ever had before. And we end up in a place that will probably change the psyche of the market, change the psyche for producers, and change the psyche for a lot of other people, because we're in a manageable situation that we've recovered from before, and we've still got growth in the utilization, and maybe that opens back up. But there are still challenges to it. Number one challenge, it's not just what does China do with trade, it's what can China actually have for demand. If we look at African swine fever, ASF, over there in China, right now they have depopulated a large portion of their swine herd. They are the world's largest swine herd. They are a large consumer of pork. One that may be good for our Iowa hog producers, and obviously we're number one when you start talking about those pigs that are going to produce pork. But the other aspect is we have a lot of soybeans here as well, and we'd like to be able to move those. So we would like to see some stability, because a large portion of what China had purchased from us prior were the variety meats, those meats that we didn't necessarily have as high a value on here in the United States. To bring that closer to home, though, look at the basis levels that we've been having. So the basis being, what is my cash price in compared to the board price that we see coming out of Chicago, theoretically, what used to be traded in the pits, shall we say. So if you look at that basis level, we have an extremely wide basis level right now. I mean, you can talk about basis level, you know, in the 90 cents, a dollar range almost for soybeans. And when I was driving up here and listening to the radio, and I heard some of these markets called, and I'm hearing $8 soybeans, that's tough when the market on Chicago is $9. It's a global marketplace up there right now. And it's really difficult to think that that's not the price we're getting. We're getting something generally lower because of that basis difference, because we've got so many soybeans. We've got, you know, a relatively stronger market right now for corn in the state, but it's again, it's the soybean side that's going to drive a lot of those question marks across a large portion of corn and soybean country, and anything we can do to enhance demand for those soybeans is going to be great. The other challenge this year, obviously, you think about the water that's out there. As I came up, I-29 south is shut down. I-29 right. North, I can look to the left, I can look to the right. I saw center pivots that were underwater. I mean, that's an impressive sight, but not impressive in a good way. Let me explain basis just a little bit. So your basis is the difference between what you have on the board price, what futures are traded at, versus what price I'm able to go sell for at my local marketplace, my cash price. So we would typically consider basis to be board price minus cash price. So if I had a 90 cent basis, that's not good, because that's generally a negative way, because the board price is higher than my cash price. So the higher the basis, generally the worse we're talking about. If I had a negative basis, my cash price could be higher. So let's say my corn basis might have been 5 cents over the board. Fantastic. It probably means I've got an ethanol plant or a large-scale user real close by that's demanding a lot of corn and is taking it in. That's what would drive basis in a good direction for the farmer. So, but when we talk about these very wide basis levels, they are exceptionally wide. We have mapped out, again, the basis levels that are reported from iDolls. The basis levels right now are some of the widest basis and most difficult to overcome that we've seen for a while. So it's a distinct challenge out there in the marketplace right now.
Jim, do you agree with a lot of what he says? Kind of complicated for the person who's not in ag. It's a lot more complicated than we might think. Hearing all this.
Yes, I would agree with everything that Sam said there. We've seen the widest basis levels I've experienced on soybeans since I've started farming. And so that does have a major effect on the price that we get for beans. Another thing that I think we're going to see it happen here in the near future with all the flooding that we've had going on is our ethanol plants and the damage that's been done to the infrastructure in Nebraska and Iowa, South Dakota and Missouri. Our roads are in bad shape. Lots of bridges have went out. Railroad beds have been washed out. So it's gonna be a challenge in some areas to get corn into the ethanol plants to be processed. And it's gonna be a bigger challenge for the ethanol industry to move their ethanol to market, because the trains are not going to be running for a while. I know the two ethanol plants that we deliver corn to, we've already seen them cut their production in half already, just because they are not able to get rid of the product. And so I think we're going to see a wider basis coming on corn as well, because of the flooding concerns and that type of thing going on as well.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, I was reading that the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase said he was confident the trade war would end soon, and it's brought China to the table to talk about economic issues, and the economy's still doing well. I guess I want to ask you guys over here. I'll start with Darren. Darren Tooley, what do you think about that?
I would say, as an optimist, I think that we're not really seeing a lot of indicators that really specifically say that this is going to happen. We're all hopeful that deals get struck with China, that things get settled out. But even if it does, we're still going to feel the impact for years to come.
You know, I'm not a media person, but I just got on my phone breaking news from the Wall Street Journal. President Trump says his administration was discussing leaving tariffs in place on Chinese goods for a substantial period of time. So I'm just interrupting you now because I thought that might be good.
Oh, he tweeted? Oh, awesome.
I don't know if it's the Wall Street Journal, but you might want to take into consideration that he's going to leave the tariffs in effect. It's being reported right now. I thought that might be
it seemed like before he was talking about, this is going to end soon.
Well, I think what we have to realize is that we will never go back to the way things were pre-tariff. We are in a new normal now, and there were originally supposed to be an increase in tariffs that would have taken place right in the beginning of March, and those were deferred back in January, and they said there would be a 90-day period for negotiation. Well, gosh, you know what that means is it's coming to an end here in a hurry. And I think that that will really, I think we're in a wait and see kind of time for the economic effects of these tariffs, because if that tariff increases, it's an increase from 10% to 25%, then that is going to cause further retaliation. And I think that's what we don't need. I mean, President Trump has actually said he would consider tariffs on everything that China sends to the United States. And we don't know what that would look like. And so I think uncertainty is really what the economy is in.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. That kind of is secondary to the Fed and the interest rates, because usually that's what people worry about when we look at the economy, but not now.
Well, and I think the strengthening dollar is another issue here that we haven't even touched on.
Right, right. So as we go forward here, I know, Darren, you had said to me earlier, and we talked about the fact that when this ends, there's a lot that still has to shake out from it. There'll be after effects, and there's a kind of a long road.
Yeah, you know, we've kind of heard pieces of that throughout the whole hour we've been here. As you look at it, whether it's the purchasing of equipment, you know, the old adage is you buy when times are good and you try to pay for them when times are bad. And so these farmers are trying to work through payments when their income has been reduced. But as we now, maybe if we do work out of this and we see a couple years of positive growth, that doesn't mean that they're going to go out and buy new machinery. They've got to restabilize the financial statement. So it doesn't instantaneously fix it. So everything that we do is delayed, and we only see it 2 to 3 years when we finally work out of things. It just leaves a lot of effect throughout the whole industry.
There were some anecdotal reports about farmers delaying buying new equipment, fixing equipment, trying to fix their own equipment because it costs so much just to maintain that equipment, and it is so expensive.
Yeah, maintaining equipment does get to be very expensive, and a lot of people will, you know, I think we've seen more farmers go towards lease options, which can provide some positive manner in regards to just eliminating the need to pay for repairs. Some people do try to continue to trade every year, just because making a payment can be cheaper than the repairs. But you know, a lot of people are trying to maybe go to cheaper machinery or older machinery, and just trying to, again, just trying to keep a watchful eye on that expense part of their balance sheet.
And you know, Dave, does that obviously steel and aluminum, does that play a part in the pricing of these?
Yeah, I mean, the utilization of those products, you know, the demand, which isn't great right now for those products, is clearly drives the demand, and therefore the pricing, and the pricing can also dictate the consumption, because when the pricing's artificially 30-40% higher than maybe it should be because of tariffs, all of a sudden a grain bin or a trailer might cost a lot more, quite a bit more. I mean, it depends how much labor goes into things. I would say, you know, back to the comment about the tweet or comment about the maybe we'll leave these tariffs on. I think it's important that we all you know, kind of separate the negotiating tactics from the real end game of what's going on here. And I would say that it's not surprising that the president would at some point, you know, use some brinkmanship, if you will, to say, you know, screw it, we're going to just leave these things on forever, to try and ratchet up the intenseness of the negotiations coming to a head. It's a good negotiating technique. It's also a negotiating technique he seems to use consistently over and over that people tend to respond to. So I'm not surprised to see that. And I would say that really until you see some kind of actual agreement, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that's been announced only has so much impact on the actual markets itself until there's something really concrete. I think once you see something concrete, tariffs come off for Canada, tariffs come off for Mexico, then you'll actually see some movement. But I would say until these deadlines pass and until something definitive is finalized, you know, I don't know. It changes so much, it's hard to lose a lot of sleep over it at this point. So,
right. You know, Dr. Funk, a lot of this conversation about tariffs has been very politically charged, with people who like the president, people who don't like the president. I think it's kind of interesting sort of taking it away from the political side of it and looking at the numbers and the facts. I think that helps a lot.
Well, and you have to look at the numbers and the facts, because that's what you're going to deal with going forward. The politics can obviously shift markets and can shift sentiment, but you're going to tend to come back toward the facts. And if you will think about the fundamentals, the supply, the demand situation, what people are going to demand, what we want to make sure, as Jim had referenced earlier, farmers would rather get their monies from the marketplace than to have to get their monies from another source that's being able to replace part of that profitability we've expected from the marketplace. So, you know, our hope is that we're able to get through these situations, manage our ways forward, and be able to find back to, you know, providing the world with that the safest, most abundant, most efficiently produced food supply that's available. And that starts basically right here in Iowa and out from the United States. So, Jim, sorry, and Nebraska. You're welcome. So let me not negate my brethren over to the west. But, you know, the U.S. does have the safest, most abundant food supply that's out there, and we are the envy of the world. That's part of the reason that we've seen China want to buy so much of those products in the past and a lot of other nations. I mean, you know, Jim mentioned about 60% of our soybeans being exported, and obviously that ties back into some of the comments you had earlier. 60% includes the weight of the soybean oil and the soybean meal that we also process here. We process over 50% of the soybeans, but we export some of that production. What we'd like to be able to see is that we get to obtain a lot of that value here and be able to provide the world with all of those products that we're so good at producing and doing in such an efficient manner, and be able to get paid equitably in a fair market situation for what we do. Right. And I think that's the important aspect of thinking about politics. Do our politics get us there?
Right, right. Do you think that, is anybody here have a question or something they'd like to say? Dolph?
They said that the mic doesn't
work. Yeah. Oh, it doesn't work. Oh, okay.
I'm a farmer in Northwest Iowa, and I've been farming for, maybe 10 years. And we have farm organizations. And Jim, we're the head of the Soybean Association, and Dr. Funk, you work with the Farm Bureau Association. And these associations, what I've seen of them is they really believe in American exceptionalism. And like Jim, you made a comment in the beginning, we were mad at the Chinese because they didn't want to accept the product that we wanted to give them. We're trying to sell someone something. If I make bad cars and I'm Ford, am I going to blame the consumer for not buying my car? And we need to realize that we are now in a world market that we are trying to sell to everyone. And if we don't make something that they want, we can't blame them for it. Then I'll talk to Dr. Sam Head.
You can go,
and,
Sam. It's okay.
Dr. Funk.
My name's Sam. Go ahead.
Sam, we had an issue on why we got into this trade war. And one of you said they were stealing our intellectual property. So isn't it quite ironic that now the vast majority of our sales went to South America, and I know one of the great competitions that the South American have is they don't pay for intellectual property like Jim and I do. Like, I pay over $100 an acre in intellectual property, and that same guy in South America has been running those beans. Going through, there's a guy from Iowa who went down there and built a facility to make all of the chemicals without paying Monsanto, without paying anybody. And so we need to realize as an industry that we need to provide to the market. And we can't cut our nose off to spite our face. And we can't say, we're so great, they can't do it without us. Because South America, 12 years ago or 13 years ago, was a pimple. And right now, they produce twice as many soybeans as we do. And when we make our consumer mad at us, the Chinese, with our pigs, you don't think that they're going to go, well, Smithfield Foods. Who owns Smithfield Foods?
It's owned by a Chinese conglomerate.
They won't go build a facility in South America, right? We are in a trade war with a dictator. And when you're in a trade war with a dictator, you don't squeeze him. If he shows weakness, you know what happens to dictators that show weakness? We know what happens. They end up crawling out of culvert you know, somewhere in the Middle East and getting their head whacked off. So if you think our American exceptionalism is going to scare these guys, I mean, they literally will get an award for starving people, literally, the chairman of those countries. So we need to understand that if we're going to sell stuff to these people, right, we can't think we're the only people in the world that can do it. So that's my point. We need to be competitive and not and take our head out of the clouds.
Why don't we go around and everyone can respond. Dave Bernstein?
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes down to the fact of, is this a negotiating tactic that ends here in the next month or two, in which case it would probably be somewhat effective, or is this something we're living with another year from now, which maybe doesn't make it effective? I mean, the Chinese economy is mediocre presently, so this could be having some impact on them. And, I mean, to your point, it's a great point. It depends on how long this goes on to whether it really moves the needle or not. Right, depending on whether that happens, ends today or out of deference to the folks that can't hear you on the radio, out of deference to whether this ends in a month with a settlement with China, which would be great, or it continues on. I think that's really the gist of responding to your point.
Briefly, Dr. Funk?
Briefly, let me just say, first off, if you look at groups like the U.S. Soybean Export Council, Iowa Soy, Nebraska Soy, the investments they make in building the relationships, they're not saying our product is superior, you can't do it without us. They're trying to get everybody to come in there and build those relationships to move forward. We've seen the impact of South America. We know how that change has grown for decades. Trust me, much longer than you've been farming. And it is something where we are trying to build those relationships and trying to provide what the world needs. The world has told us they like what we have. It's a matter now of, can we go ahead and deliver on that and have access to those markets?
Okay. Jim Miller, can you give me 30 to 45 seconds?
I guess just one comment. You said that South America doesn't pay any royalty fees for their technology anymore. Here in the U.S., they collect the royalty fees for technology on the front end when we buy the seed. In South America, they are now collecting it on the back end when they sell the seed. So there is that technology agreement down in South America now that where they are collecting that when they sell their grain now. So they are paying, may not be quite as much as what we are here, but they are paying royalty.
When they sell it at the marketplace.
When they sell it at the marketplace, it is collected there.
Right. So if they feed a pig?
If they bought the beans, when they go to market those beans, they pay for that tech fee in beans, in bags of beans.
Merzik?
I think that one of the really important points you've brought up is that the government of China is not like the government of the United States. And we always have to keep that in the front of our heads when we are dealing with China, because they don't have the same politics, they don't have the same freedoms, they don't have the same guarantees. They are not the United States, and we always have to think about that.
Darren?
The only thing I would really say there is it's no different than myself helping a neighbor bring them up. I mean, there's going to be balance. You're always going to have high, low. They have different soils from what I understand. They're never going to produce the way, I shouldn't say never, but they struggle to maybe produce a little bit of the way we do. Obviously, bean market may be different than the corn market. Infrastructure, they're going to battle that. So I think we're doing a lot of the right things. You know, the reasons that we're doing it, I think, are for the right purpose. And I think the world consumption is going to grow. And so I don't know that the U.S. will ever be able to sustain and be able to provide that as consumption grows.
And thanks, Darren Tooley. You're the Vice President of Ag Lending at Security National Bank. Thanks for being here.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And Mary Zink, you are an Assistant Professor of Business Administration at Morningside College. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And Jim Miller, a farmer, former head of the Nebraska Soybean Association. Thank you for coming.
You bet, Mary. Thank you for the invite.
It was good. And also Dr. Sam Funk of the Iowa Farm Bureau.
Thank you for having me.
And Sam, I'm sorry, Sam. You're Sam. You're Dave Bernstein, State Steel. Thank you. And thanks everyone that came. Thank you to Dolph and all the folks here. We appreciate it. You've been listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.